Welcome to Marissa's Wicked Word Nosh, a place to chow down on topics relevant to writers of all kinds.
Hello, and welcome to Marissa's Wicked Word Nosh. I'm Marissa, and this is a weekly podcast in which I talk about a wide variety of writing-related topics. And sometimes I discuss a topic that's not specifically writing related because it's one that writers, among other creative types, need to know about so that they can know how they and their works are protected under the law. That's sort of what I've been doing these past few weeks. I spent 2 weeks talking about the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And last week, I provided what I intended to be an overview of the basics of U.S. copyright law, even though I think it turned out to be one of my longest solo episodes since I started this podcast in 2019. I'm going to continue my discussion of copyright law this week, but before I do, I just want to let everyone listening know that I'm focusing on U.S. law right now because I live in the U.S., and U.S. law is what I'm most familiar with as a result. That said, I am very interested in speech and copyright laws in other countries, and I have a number of international listeners for whom I am incredibly grateful. It's been amazing to find out where some of my listeners live, and I would really like to learn more about some of the laws that writers need to be aware of where you live. So if you're listening right now and you're outside the U.S., I would really love it if you could reach out to me and tell me a little bit about how things like copyright are handled where you live. If you're a writer or work with writers and are open to coming on my show to discuss how you handle issues like these, I'd be more than happy to have you on. I think it's important for writers to know a bit about how issues like copyright are handled in other countries, since the majority of writers, no matter where they live, hopefully would like to be published in other countries one day. Another thing that I need to stress is that I'm not an expert in this stuff. I'm not a lawyer, but I attended law school, didn't finish, but I did attend, and I have taken a few classes over the years. And I think it's important that writers have some general knowledge of how this stuff works. Even if you decide to let a lawyer handle these matters when your own work is published, you should know a little bit about what they're doing, because you should know what your rights are. And if you're a lawyer who's listening to this, which wouldn't be all that strange because a lot of people who get degrees in English or literature end up going to law school, and some former lawyers have gone on to become best-selling authors such as John Grisham, let me know if you'd like to come on my show because I would love to have you on. Anyway, last week I started by providing a definition of copyright law from the freedictionary.com, which I'm including a link to once again this week. That site defines copyright as, quote, a legal device that gives the creator of a literary, artistic, musical, or other creative work the sole right to publish and sell that work. Copyright owners have the right to control the reproduction of their work, including the right to receive payment for that reproduction, end quote. I describe the exclusive rights of copyright holders. Usually, copyright holders are the writers or creators themselves, and how long works are currently protected by copyright before they pass into the public domain. And I also briefly talked about registering copyrights and notice. An example of notice is that page you see at the beginning of most books that has the little C in a circle next to the author's name and the phrase, all rights reserved, somewhere on the page. I also included some examples of works that aren't currently protected under U.S. copyright law, such as most phone listings and speeches that aren't captured on someone's smartphone, and blank forms like checks, and words, ideas, and titles. Aside from ideas, it may seem like there's not a whole heck of a lot of stuff that you can copy without getting permission from the author, and I just want to make this clear, you shouldn't even copy ideas. It's just sometimes you have an idea and somebody else has an idea, and they just happen to be very similar. So that's Boy, ideas aren't protected, but you shouldn't intentionally copy somebody's idea. That's what I'm trying to say. And the same holds true for writing. If you want to be a writer, why would you want to copy a substantial amount from someone else's work? First of all, that kind of thing can be easily discovered. But also, a lot of people become writers precisely because they have vivid imaginations and want to bring the worlds that they have in their head to the printed page, or the screen, or into song lyrics. However, there are times when adding a bit from someone else's work might be appropriate to give your audience a more comprehensive understanding of the point you're trying to make. For example, if you're watching CNN or MSNBC and they include a few lines from a New York Times or Washington Post story in a news segment, or sometimes they even include a screenshot from the article on the screen, including part of that story will help to impress upon viewers just how big the story is. Or you may be asked to review an album for your college newspaper. A longtime friend of mine and friend of the show, I'd recommend you go back and listen to my interview with him last March, David W. Jacobson, has recently had his latest album reviewed in several college newspapers. If you're a writer for a college newspaper, maybe you've received a copy of David's album, POTUS, which I'll also include a link to in the notes for this episode, and would like to include a few lines from a song in your review to demonstrate to readers how witty David's writing is. Under U.S. copyright law, using another artist's work in this way is often permitted under what's known as the Fair Use Doctrine. According to an article by Rich Stimm called What is Fair Use? Fair use consists of, quote, any copying of copyrighted material done for a limited and transformative purpose, such as to comment upon, criticize, or parody a copyrighted work. Such uses can be done without permission from the copyright owner, end quote. I think it's important to stress two words in that definition. The first one, limited, means, obviously, you ideally use only a few lines, and they probably should be pretty directly relevant to the overall point you're trying to make. If you feel the need to include entire paragraphs from an article you read on, say, astrology, I don't know where I came up with that, I just happen to like astrology. In your own article on astrology, you probably don't understand astrology well enough to write about it. Not yet, anyway. As for the other word in Stimm's description that needs to be emphasized, transformative, unfortunately, Stimm says that trying to gauge exactly how transformative a use of part of someone's work is can be difficult. And part of the reason for that might be that courts have felt there needs to be some leeway in this area. What might be considered fair use in one context, say in a student newspaper, might not be so fair in another, say a best-selling novel. However, another article I'm including a link to from the U.S. Copyright Office, called More Information on Fair Use, considers transformative uses, quote, those that add something new, with a further purpose or different character, and do not substitute for the original use of the work, end quote. The U.S. Copyright Office article lists some examples of fair use under Section 107 of the Copyright Act, including, quote, criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, and research, end quote. And it's important to note before I go any further that fair use is considered an affirmative defense to a copyright infringement claim, which means that a question of whether something you do is fair use probably won't arise unless someone tries to sue you for copyright infringement, which I hope never happens. However, it is good to know which categories generally are considered to fall under fair use, and it's pretty easy to see why some leeway is allowed in this area of law, as I was just saying. In addition to what I mentioned a few minutes ago about portions of news stories being mentioned in TV broadcasts or song lyrics quoted in an album review, think about how difficult it would have been in school if, for example, teachers had to get permission from every author or the author's estate prior to assigning book reports to students, at least on books that weren't in the public domain. Of course, some of you might be thinking, now that would have been great because I wouldn't have had so many boring papers to write. I know, this is a writing podcast. We're supposed to enjoy writing. But if you didn't enjoy writing every paper you had to write when you were in school, you have nothing to apologize for. I certainly wasn't fond of writing every paper I had to write. But from an educational perspective, that would be less than ideal. The scenario I just described could possibly limit what text teachers could assign to their students, which would therefore limit students' ability to find out and read a lot of material. Plus, researchers in the physical and social sciences often include quotes from earlier papers and journal articles on similar topics, not because they're trying to pass the earlier writings off as their own, for the most part anyway, every once in a while you do hear about a researcher plagiarizing, but most are careful to cite the authors, the titles of the previous works, and the journals or books they appeared in. But this type of research is generally known for building on previous research. As far as other areas that qualify, if we go back to short examples of song lyrics or excerpts from a book that are included in reviews for those very works, a little fair use really is called for promotional purposes. It would actually be kind of ludicrous if you were going to write a review of, say, the new Stephen King book. And yes, there is a new Stephen King book coming out. I didn't know that when I was writing this script, but I just assumed there was one coming out soon because, you know, that's how Stephen King rolls. He puts out at least one new book a year. And sure enough, I saw this morning that I could pre-order his upcoming book through the Kindle store. So, yeah, Stephen King has a new book coming out. But anyway, if you were going to write a review of Stephen King's new book and you weren't able to include a few lines of it in your review, what would be the point of that? I mean, your readers would be reading a review of that very book, and they would know who wrote it, and it's also safe to assume that most of them would understand why you're including that in your review. I think you get the idea. In just about all of these cases, your audience is going to know what you're citing a lot of the time. And when they don't, that's why you're supposed to include a biography that follows proper MLA or APA or Chicago format. There's another area that often qualifies as fair use, which Stim mentioned, and that's parody. Stim defines parody as, quote, a work that ridicules another, usually well-known work, by imitating it in a comic way. Judges understand that, by its nature, parody demands some taking from the original work being parodied. End quote. Stim goes on to suggest that in parody, you might see a more extensive use of another's work than you would in a research paper or on a TV news broadcast, because the parodist needs to, quote unquote, conjure up the spirit of the work it was based on in order to be successful. And by successful, I mean for the work to resonate with its audience, not necessarily for it to make a ton of money. Although some, like recording artist Weird Al, have certainly been able to build careers on parody. I remember being excited to find a parody of Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis at the dollar store a few years back. I still have it. I actually put a picture on Twitter yesterday. It's called The Meowmorphosis. The same publishing company, which is Quirk Books, gave us, let me see, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters, and Android Karenina. So, again, the people reading these books are going to know that Kafka and Jane Austen and Tolstoy wrote the original works, and as a result, they're not likely to confuse them with the parodies. And they'll also understand that the writers of the parodies were probably intending to inject a little humor into their interpretations of the classics, although I always found Kafka himself pretty amusing when I read him. But if the person looking at the parodies never read Kafka or Austen, they're probably not going to get the parody. The same goes for someone who hears Weird Al's Eat It, but who's never heard Michael Jackson's Beat It, or Weird Al's Like a Surgeon, and who hasn't never heard Madonna's Like a Virgin. That's why, as Stim says, a parodist is often allowed to use as much of the original work as is needed to evoke the original in the mind of the reader or listener. However, similar to what Stim was saying about trying to define what's transformative, an article from FineLaw.com called Parody, Fair Use or Copyright Infringement, explains that courts have struggled numerous times in deciding which examples of parody count as fair use and which ones constitute copyright infringement. In case you're wondering why the parodist wouldn't just try to prevent a potential lawsuit by getting permission from the original artist by putting their parody out there, Fine Law calls it, quote, highly unlikely that a copyright owner will grant permission or a license to a parodist to use their copyright-protected work in creating a parody, end quote. So, there you go. I'm going to briefly discuss the four factors that are considered by courts in analyzing a fair use case. The first is the purpose and character of the use of the original work. The U.S. Copyright Office notes that this is where the court looks at whether the work is for commercial or nonprofit purposes, as well as whether the later work can be considered transformative. According to the U.S. Copyright Office, courts are often more likely to find works created for nonprofit and/or educational purposes more fair than works created for commercial purposes. However, it's important to emphasize that this is not always the case. Again, this is only the first step in this type of analysis. A court will then go on to look at the nature of the copyrighted work, which the U.S. Copyright Office calls, quote, the degree to which the work that was used relates to copyright's purpose of encouraging creative expression, end quote. Here, the Fine Law piece notes that fact-based works normally are granted more leeway when it comes to fair use than more creative works, whose main purpose is for aesthetic appreciation or entertainment. And that's understandable, I think. A research paper's primary purpose is to educate, which is generally seen as having more value on a societal level than a witty adaptation of a popular song whose primary intention is to amuse people. Not that that's not a valid intention, I totally believe it is. But also, works will look at whether the original work is published or unpublished. If it's unpublished, it's probably easier to make a case that the person copying it is infringing, which I think is understandable. The third factor that's examined is the amount and substantiality of the original work that's used. According to Fine Law, the most important consideration here is, quote, whether the quality and value of the material copied from the original copyrighted work is reasonable in relation to the purpose of copying, end quote. Again, there is no tried and true standard that sets out how much copying can be considered reasonable. It's going to vary based on the type of fair use case it is and the copier's purpose. But Fine Law explains that courts usually look at whether copiers take more than is necessary for the purpose of what they're trying to accomplish. After looking at that, courts consider the final factor, the effect upon the copyrighted work's potential market or value. In other words, can the copied work cause any harm which could be financial or reputational or both to the original work? According to Fine Law, a fair use defense is less likely to hold up in court if the later work effectively becomes a substitute for the original. Going back to the Kafka parody I bought at the dollar store, and honestly, I think a lot of Kafka's works are in the public domain. There might be some translations that are not, but he did pass away in 1924, which was almost 100 years ago. So I think a number of his works are in the public domain. And also, he was Czech. He was from the Czech Republic. So I'm actually not sure if how copyright covers current copyright laws in the US would affect his works. But let's just assume for a second that the Metamorphoses was still protected by copyright law. Going back to that parody, I think it's a fun little book. And I don't mean little as an insult, it's a short book. And the original is certainly not what one would call a lengthy tome. I feel hardcore fans of the real Metamorphoses would probably appreciate it. At least they'd get a few laughs out of it. On the other hand, if given the choice between the Kafka work and the parody, I would strongly opt in favor of Kafka himself. However, there may be some parodies that are a lot more enjoyable to read than the original, which may cause the author of the original to lose book sales he or she may otherwise have had. In that case, a court is likely to find that the more successful parody was not a fair use. So that's all I have to say about fair use for now. But I do hope you'll check out the links and maybe even find some other articles on your own to learn more about fair use. Even if you don't ever see yourself trying to write a parody, fair use covers a lot more than parody. Parody gets a lot of the attention because it's fun, but all types of writers have either dealt with fair use issues wittingly or unwittingly in the past, or will at some point in the future. I think it's important to remember that sometimes fair use is necessary, but it's a good idea when you need to include part of someone's work in your own to think about how much you really need to include. Don't think that more equals better, and that as a result, including more of another person's work than may be needed to get your point across is the way to go. You're probably tired of hearing this expression, but less is more is a good rule of thumb here. And always, always, always acknowledge the copyrighted source material. I said this last week, but it's very important, so I'll say it again. Copyright infringement can be unintentional. Something that you read but have no intention of using in your journal article, say, may still make its way in there. Err on the side of caution and at least cite it in your bibliography if you don't actually mention it in the text. As I was saying at the beginning of the show, let me know what you think about copyright. Or let me know what you'd like me to talk about in a future episode. Email me at marissadelefarfalle@gmail.com and follow me on Twitter at @marissad13 and on Instagram at www.instagram.com/marissadf13. Also, please check out my Patreon page at www.patreon.com/marissadf. For $1 a month, I'll mention you in an upcoming episode. And for $3 a month, I'll not only mention you in an upcoming episode, but I'll also give you exclusive access to two bonus episodes each month. I put one February bonus episode up there last week, and I'll have another one up soon. And if you become a patron, in addition to those, you can also access the ones I did in January and back in December. I'd also really appreciate it if you could take a moment to rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcasting platform, as it'll help a lot more people find out about the show. I'm going to leave you with a quote I found online about fair use that I kind of think puts the uncertainty surrounding what's considered fair use or transformative into perspective. Because I know uncertainty drives a lot of people mad. But uncertainty is not always a bad thing, and sometimes it's good that we have a little bit of it. This quote is from Robin Gross, who said, quote, "Fair use is always going to be a gray area, and it should be. we need to allow for things we can't see yet. End quote. Thank you for listening and for all of your support. I am so grateful for all of you, and I hope you've learned a lot from my examination of copyright law. So until next time, please stay safe and peace out.
This podcast has been brought to you by Anchor, which is the easiest way to make a podcast. Go to anchor.fm for more info.